Blog Talk Radio.
You're in the bullpen with Dr. T, hosted by Dr. Marvin Thompson, an empowering educator featured on CNN, PBS, CBS Morning Show, and the Oprah Winfrey Network. In the Bullpen with Dr. T covers the relevant issues of the day affecting our schools, families, and communities. Here's your host, Dr. T.
Tonight we are back, and this time we're talking. Our topic tonight is bullying or harassment, as many of the experts that we've had on this show have defined it. But for those of you, I can tell you, I posted something on my foundation Facebook page a couple of months ago about bullying. And one of the responses that I received was basically, what are you talking about? Isn't bullying a rite of passage? Come on, we complain about everything these days. Well, initially, it just annoyed the hell out of me. And then I had to do some thinking on it. And I noticed a pattern in those responses. It seemed that all of the responses that suggested that bullying was a rite of passage in a normal development cycle, part of the development cycle for young people, shouldn't be made a big deal about. What are we complaining about? I'm going to tell you that there are a lot of people around the country who don't feel that way, who feel that we have a predator versus prey mentality in our schools and in our communities. One such community is in North Tonawanda, New York, where they just passed a law last month that criminalizes bullying behavior. And here's the take on this. If you're a parent of a child who bullies more than once, you face criminal charges, including jail time, including fines. I'm going to play a clip for you about this new law in North Carolina, New York. And trust me, bullying is an issue in this country. It takes on many, many different facets, many different reasons, many strategies. That's what we're going to talk about tonight. But I want you to first hear why and how this new law came about from the very people in that town.
If a child is caught bullying or attacking another student, their parent will pay the fine or do the time. The parent could spend up to 15 days in jail and pay $250. The North Tonawanda Common Council unanimously passed the new law last week.
We didn't feel like maybe anything was being done. And then all of a sudden I heard about this ordinance going through. So it was shocking and welcome.
Victoria Crago's son was attacked by his classmates in June. It happened off school grounds, but it pushed Crago to do something. And she found out other parents had complained of violence at North Tonawanda Middle School, too, which led to the Facebook group, the North Tonawanda Coalition for Safe Schools and Streets. Crago hopes this new law will help prevent other kids from getting hurt.
I think that these teens have figured out that they can get away with this, which is why they're repeat offenders. But if there's a tougher law in place, that may give them pause.
We want the message out there that we're serious about this. We don't want anyone to be afraid to be in our city or to walk the streets or go to school.
North Tonawanda Mayor Art Pappas says the city isn't trying to focus on punishment, but more so prevention. And he says it's geared towards repeat offenders.
I think it's going to get a message out there that certain parents who haven't now have to take some responsibility for their children.
Well, as you can see, someone is taking this seriously. And to address this issue, I didn't want to just sit. I'm no expert on bullying. And if you all have been followers of this show, you may recall several months ago, I held a serious anti-bullying. And I had some of the top experts in the country on bullying come on this show to address it. One of them is I'm very lucky to have her and able to get her on board. She's a very busy lady. She spends a great deal of time. Folks, when I tell you that if there's anything you want to know about existing bullying practices, behavior, laws, policies, ways that we can address them, this is one of the top people in this country on this topic. I cannot overstate that at all. There are a lot of good ones. We had all on, and she is among the best of them. So I want to welcome our guest tonight, the president and founder of Embrace Civility, Ms. Nancy Willard.
Thank you.
Hello.
Very much.
You're very welcome, Nancy. Look, let me get first, before we get into some of the practices that are going on and what bullying really means, because it's changed a lot. And let me share this with the audience. I prefaced even the clip that bullying, although it's been around forever, it has taken on new forms. We have new mediums. And Ms. Willard wrote the very first book in this country, in the world, on cyberbullying. This was decades ago at the very onset of it. So when I tell you she's been at the forefront of bullying and examining this issue, that's how out in front she has been on this topic. Nancy, back up and just tell us, what's your take on, let's just get to this law. Is this where we are now, that we have to start passing laws to criminalize bullying behavior and then jail and fine parents who don't respond?
This law is a response to frustration because what schools are doing to try to stop bullying flat is not working. And the evidence is clear on that. And the evidence in the state of New York is actually very interesting, because the evidence demonstrates the failure of the statutory approaches that are being implemented in every 50 state. Now, in 2011, New York enacted their well-touted Dignity for All Students Act. This act had a very specific definition of bullying and also contained a provision that required schools to make public annual reports of how many students, how many bullying incidents they had. Now, no school wants to have this public report. So in 2015-16 school year, 71% of New York City schools had zero bullying incidents. Now, if you believe that, I got this bridge I'd like to sell you there, except the traffic sometimes slows down on it. Zero bullying incidents. Okay, Youth Risk Behavior Survey, which is a biannual survey that has a question on there about bullying, on that survey, from 2011, 17.7% of students reported they had been bullied. And in 2015, that had increased to 20.6%. So we have a situation where under the statutes, some of these statutes in Florida, New Jersey, New York, other states, included this public report of bullying incidents. No principal wants to report this. It's a black mark on their face. So what they do is they look very closely at the definition of bullying, and they say, oh, well, you didn't meet this definition. And there are some states where there's even this decision grid flow chart for the principal to say, well, it has to be one of these criteria to be considered bullying. Okay? So bad approach, and here's what's worse. Under the Every Student Succeeds Act, all schools are now required to make annual public reports of bullying incidents. So the same factors that have resulted in my opinion, an increase in bullying in New York and this absolute abysmal response by principals that there weren't any bullying incidents, those forces are now in play throughout, for every school in the United States.
How much of what you're talking about is, and I get that clearly, as a former principal, one of the things that I had to address very early on with my administrators and teachers was teach them how to, what the definition of bullying was. And it's stratified. It's not, it's woven throughout the entire conduct everywhere. It's woven throughout civil law everywhere. But we seem to want to encapsulate it into a specific behavior and a very narrow view. How much of this is the fact that many of us have our own mental model of bullying, and that when we engage in conversations about it, we're all operating out of different mental models?
Right. There are actually three primary definitions of bullying, and they're all in conflict. There was actually a document the U.S. Department of Education prepared on the bullying laws and statutes, which stated in an incredible understatement that the lack of consistency in how these definitions are presented is a problem. Okay, so there's an academic definition, repeated intentional behavior where there's an imbalance of power. The problem is the concept of imbalance of power is not objective and simply can't be used in a disciplinary concept area. For example, you've got a tall, very physically fit lesbian basketball player and a petite, popular cheerleader who are involved in hurtful behavior. Is there an imbalance of power? They can't, you know. So what the statutes have all included essentially what is a legal definition, which is repeated or persistent hurtful behavior that has to have emotional distress that is interfering with their education. Now, this is the statute then that school officials go through, and others in some states there's a lot of other little fiddly bits added. And then you've got the general concept of bullying is when somebody is hurtful to me and I can't get it to stop. So I saw a document, literally, I have seen many documents for educators, but I saw one that had the academic definition on page one, the statutory definition on page two, no discussion of what the differences might be, and a survey at the end that asked students if somebody was hurtful to them. So it's not surprising that principals are confused. In fact, I want to say, I'm going to go back. There is zero evidence of what schools are doing to try to reduce bullying and respond to the incidents is effective. Zero evidence. And that's ample amounts of research. But the reason the schools aren't being effective is that educators have not been provided with accurate information about the nature of bullying behavior. And what educators have been told to do is largely an adult control rules and punishment approach, which is going to be entirely ineffective. So educators aren't at fault, but we have got to create a greater understanding of what's going on. Actually want to shift. I like to shift in two ways. First of all, instead of preventing bullying, what we need to do is establish a positive school climate where that fosters positive relations, kindness, inclusion, civility, and that is our focus. And we need to prevent and effectively respond to all forms of hurtful behavior. And let's get away from this disciplinary mess.
Okay, so let's break that down for a little bit, because okay. I want to approach this and take it to where grandma can get it, right? Because here's what I find when parents go into schools, and I chastise schools for doing this. This is why parents have a difficult time building strong homeschool relationships with schools, is because when they go in, they get a lot of jargon talk. And I'm going to tell you, Mike, my experience has always been, and I always tell my teachers, don't even try it, because that is an intimidation tactic. You know doggone well they don't know what you're talking about. I have friends who are in the medical profession, and they start using anachronisms when I ask them a medical question. I look at them, I'm like, you're going to have to tell me specifically what that's all about. And teachers are much the same. So let's take this conversation in a way that grandma can get it, because I also think teachers and educators will also benefit from hearing it this way, so they can that education-ese dialogue that limits their growth. That's a whole nother conversation. But define for us what specific bullying behaviors that we all see commonly, or you have seen and research shows are commonly identified bullying behaviors.
I prefer, now, by the way, I have a new book for parents that school administrators probably ought to purchase a copy of, because they might want to know what information I'm providing to parents. And the title is Support and Empower Your Bullied Child, A Guide for Parents. And this is available both as a Kindle book and a paperback on Amazon. So I asked some questions on a survey in 2015. And what I asked, I said, tell me how frequently in the last month somebody was hurtful to you. And I gave a real broad description of hurtful. The responses were never once or twice a month, once or twice a week, almost daily. And then I asked, how upset were you? And the responses was not at all upset, not that upset, upset, and very upset. And then I asked, how effective did you feel in getting this to stop by yourself? It was easy to get to stop. It was challenging but possible to get it to stop. It was very difficult or as impossible. So my sense is that we need to understand that there are a range of hurtful incidents that occur into the multiple tier system of supports, which is kind of tier one, tier two, tier three, that most educators who focus on risk prevention know about. So we've got a lot of hurtful incidents that the students are able to effectively resolve by themselves or with some support by an educator. And then we've got a group, then we've got those incidents that are more serious and chronic, and then we've got the really, really serious incidents, and almost always that involves young people who have a lot of other risks involved. They've experienced trauma, they're overreacting, they've got lots of challenges. So if we think of those incidents in that manner, one of the things we want to focus on, especially with teenagers, is they don't want adults to step in and solve their problems. They want and need to know how to effectively resolve these situations that they get involved in. And that effectiveness needs to include if somebody is hurtful to them, if they've made a mistake and it's been hurtful to somebody else, and how can they stop themselves and remedy the harm, or if they are witnessing a hurtful situation. So we've got to stop thinking that adults can control these things and help young people better risk two level, tier two or tier three level. These are more serious situations. These are situations where the students, these are when, you know, it's once or twice a week or almost daily, the student's upset or very upset, feels it's very difficult or impossible to get the situation changed. That's when the school leader, the principal, needs to be able to step in and do an in-depth investigation that finds out what the problems are, sets up a support system for the student who's being treated badly, holds the student who's been engaging in hurtful behavior accountable, and let's try to keep this out of the disciplinary system because that's just a huge mess, but holds the student accountable and make sure that the student stops for a while to make sure that the situation gets better. And then at the top level, we're going to have more intensive supports that are going to be needed. So that's how I think we need to change how we're thinking about these things.
Okay, so let's break that down. Every single state, and your work you do, I've read your outline and all of your research that you put together. One of them, you acknowledge that all states have enacted bullying prevention statutes. Every single state, all 50 states, have a promote a rules and consequences approach to bullying prevention. And they
right.
require people to have policies against bullying, instructions to students not to bully, and report if they're bullied. I get the non-reporting. And here's the thing about, for people, what Nancy acknowledged earlier, schools do not like to report incidents of fights and weapons because it does make them look bad, okay? They have to take corrective action if they reach a certain threshold. And part of the issue for me in under-reporting bullying, and this is not just under-reporting by schools. It's also under-reporting by kids, but it's a separate issue. Schools don't report typically, as you said, Nancy. They don't want to reach the threshold where they have to take corrective action. And two, they probably have a hard time doing so because they're not recording it and addressing it in real time as a bullying issue. So it's almost retrospective thinking trying to answer that question because they don't have a concrete plan. Students also, there's a pattern here where students also, it seems to be two dynamics that you may be able to help me out with. One, there's because of the underreporting by students and the low numbers, there tends to be some, I guess, a possibility of students not even being aware of the criteria for bullying, or they're afraid to report it. Is there evidence that either of these two dynamics occur?
It's not that they don't know how to report. It's that they're afraid to report. Okay, so let's go back. My cyberbullying book was not actually decades ago. It was actually published in 2007. So that was a decade ago. And what
okay,
I realized
so you're
was,
not... Go
yeah,
ahead.
Okay,
thanks for clearing that up.
What I realized when I wrote that book was that the common approach that was being the universal approach that establish rules, have staff supervise, tell students to report, and investigate and impose sanctions, that wasn't going to work in the digital age. Okay? Schools aren't making rules for sites or apps. School staff aren't present in youth digital environments. Young people don't report. They don't report cyber incidents because they know adults are going to overreact. Only about a third to 40% of students report in school hurtful acts. And then if it's digital, you know, first of all, the principal's going to have a hard time investigating. And if the principal imposes punishment, that can lead to digital retaliations outside of control. So my first approach to this, it was, excuse me, this approach isn't going to work in the digital age. Started digging into the data, and it's totally clear. This approach isn't working for in-school incidents, and it's not working for cyber incidents. It's flat not working. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So there is research that indicates why students don't report. And what's crazy on the stopbullying.gov website, it's like, well, they don't report because they're afraid of retaliation or they have some weakness or something like that. No, they don't report because they are afraid that the school isn't going to respond or it's going to make things worse. Those are the two top reasons why students don't report. And that's research I've done, but also a lot of other research.
Okay, let's address the why question. Many people might be listening. And remember, I started the show with saying that there were people who were saying, this is just a rite of passage. You're making a big deal about nothing. Why is it important that we address this, Nancy? Why
okay.
is it that we do something about this?
Okay, there's a two-part answer to that. First of all, bullying, we know from the research, can have lifelong health consequences. Stress-related physical and mental health symptoms, depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress, suicide ideation. When it's motivated by discrimination or attack on who you are, if protected class or class status, that's even worse. bullying can lead to self-harm and violence at school. And I will put this in because finally, at least in a number of states, I think it's over 50 measure under ESSA, and guess what? Bullying is totally associated with students not coming to school because they don't feel safe. So we've got to address the issue. But I want to go back to the rationale that you are hearing, and there's a very important point about that, and that comes from the research of Dr. Bandura, who focused on disengagement and rationalizations is moral disengagement. So we all have those ideas of what is right, but sometimes we don't follow what is right. And if we don't follow what is right, we create rationalizations for that. There are four key rationalizations that people who engage in hurtful behavior, people who and schools that don't respond to hurtful behavior do. Number one is they reconstrue the conduct. They spin it. So it's locker room talk. Number two is they deny personal responsibility. Everybody does it. Or it doesn't meet the statutory definition of bullying. Off campus, not my job. Okay? Number three is they deny the extent of the harm. You're overreacting. Everybody needs to be able to deal with this. You know, it was minor, blah, blah, blah. And number four, they blame the victim. If he or she would just stop doing X, Y, Z, this wouldn't happen. Okay? So everybody needs to pay attention to those four rationalizations. At a national level, you can hear them quite frequently. Those rationalizations are used to deny that you engaged in hurtful behavior and to deny the fact that you, even though it was clear you should have responded, you didn't.
Well, that's at the core of some of the issues. My experience has been, my observations have been that when schools address bullying and when you discuss it with them and their bullying policies, they stick to the policy. And then they stick to how hard it is to mitigate them. And what I always find is an absence of process. That there's two variables to me that, and this is for those who try to take a humanistic approach to addressing bullying. One, there's no real cut criteria. Two, there's no clear process. And third, there's poor communication. On the other side of this, we see schools that have done some, and there's a lot out here, there's at least a couple that I want to talk about tonight, that do get positive press. And I don't know, Nancy, if it's because of the effort that these two afford school districts, two, the clarity in which these programs work gives them, being the schools, a clean process, and thirdly, it answers the communication question. I'm not sure it answers the criteria question, but it does hit on two out of the three. And one of them is the positive behavior management system, and the other is restorative justice. I'd like for you to talk to us about some of the strengths and maybe some of the drawbacks to both of those programs, if there are any.
Okay. First, I have to discuss one other issue. First I'm going to say that I don't fault educators for their inability to do a good job here, because what they've been told about the nature of bullying is partially inaccurate. And this was the other thing that I saw when I wrote my book on cyberbullying, and there was a description of students who bully, and they are, and this, by the way, this description, trying to get it up, is still on the stopbullying.gov website. They're aggressive, easily frustrated, have less parent involvement, have issues at home, think badly of others, have difficulty following rules, view violence in a positive way, have friends who bully others, okay? That describes young people who are at risk, right?
Well, you just described me and my brothers, but go ahead.
Okay, that describes young people who are at risk. And the problem is that describes a minority of the students who are, and let me get to, this is finally becoming evidence. The National Research Council issued a report, I think it was 2016, and they said there's a stereotype held by the general public, also by educators, which is promoted by the StopBullying.gov website, that children and youth who bully have psychopathology, low social skills, possess few assets, and that's the source of bullying. However, although some of the students who engage in aggression do this, what's just shown is the students who bully others have considerable power within their peer network, are high-status perpetrators. They are perceived by their peers as being popular, socially skilled leaders. They have significant assets and competencies. They are viewed as attractive. They're good athletes. They don't have this psychopathology. This is an entire different source, and it's the primary source of bullying behavior, especially as kids move into adolescence. This is ethological-based behavior. These students who are seeking dominance engage in hurtful behavior in two ways. They denigrate those who they perceive as being deviant, different, and they engage in battles between rivals or perceived rivals. So if you can, they will peck the weak chick until it dies, and then when they mature, you got roosters going after each other to establish dominance. Now, the only difference in our middle schools is you also have the hens who are going after each other to establish dominance. Okay? So here's the key. If people don't hear anything other than this on this presentation, okay? Risk prevention approaches that incorporate trauma-informed care can be helpful to address the concerns of the at-risk students who are engaging in aggression. But risk prevention approaches will never be effective in reducing the behavior of socially skilled, competent leadership students who are hurtful to achieve dominance, because this is a risk behavior. This is dominance behavior.
And this is something we see in our schools. It starts early in elementary school. There's a hierarchy that's being developed. And I think, Nancy, what you're talking to is what some people, when they say, hey, bullying is just a rite of passage, I think, and I'm going to give them a little room here, although I'm reading back through some of the comments, I don't think so. I think some of these people are bullying themselves. I'm just saying that. It's just my take. But some of this is just establishing social dominance, as you said before, in very unproductive, unhealthy ways that not only maybe even manifest some negative behaviors long-term, negative behaviors in the bullier, but obviously we all know the impact it has on the person or persons being bullied. How much of this is just, hey, I'm the coolest kid, or I want to be, or they're giving me this status, I've got to maintain this status and this dominance in order to do so, because I'm young and dumb and I don't have any other strategies, I'm going to exert whatever social dominance I have, whether it be status for money or power or strength or popularity, I'm going to use it.
Right. That is exactly what's happening. And what we are going to have to change in our schools in order to understand that this hurtful behavior of students is fueled by their perception of the social norms, that being hurtful is the way to achieve dominance. And we have to understand that adults can't change the perspective of these social norms by enunciating expectations for school behavior. You will be respectful, be responsible, and be safe. That's not going to do a blasted thing to change students' understanding of the norms. What there's the approach that needs to be implemented is a positive social norms approach. This approach has been used to reduce binge drinking at the college level. What the reality is that even though this approach is effective in achieving dominance, students don't like to see this. Students don't admire those who are hurtful to achieve dominance. What we've got to inculcate and foster is a leadership path for those students who have leadership skills, but demonstrate their leadership by being consistently kind, respectful, inclusive, and stepping in to help others. And there are research-based strategies that we can use to do this. And that's what we've got to do. We've got to have the risk prevention approaches for the kids who have experienced trauma and are being aggressive. But we are only going to achieve effectiveness because on shifting students' perspective of the norms by providing a path for those true leaders, the kind, compassionate leaders who step in to help, assuming the position of leadership within the schools. And then we also have to focus on helping kids gain the skills they desire to be able to manage their personal relationships as the one who's being treated badly, being hurtful, or witnessing a hurtful situation. That's the underlying, okay, so that's what we've got to do with students. And then what we've got to do, there's ample research that says that school staff are really bad at responding to these situations. They occur right in front of them. And the problem is that when these hurtful incidents occur, staff have other responsibilities, like settling 35 students down to focus on what they're supposed to learn. And what they see is not the full accurate situation. So what we've got to do is support school staff in learning better ways to respond to those incidents. And then what we've got to do is support the principal in shifting from this, oh, is it a violation of the rule approach, to how can I investigate to fully understand what's going on with these kids, come up with a support plan for the kid who's being targeted, and come up with an accountability approach for the kid who's being hurtful, and monitor that. So those, you know, focusing on student leadership, student skills, staff skills in intervening and identifying the more serious situations, and principal skills in investigating and intervening in an effective manner are the three components that I think have to be implemented in our schools. And if people go to my embracecivility.org website, they can find more information on this. There's under the Embrace Civility program, there's a short, Dr. T is going to laugh because he knows I never write anything short, but I swear, this is a six-page document. I reduced over 50 pages of well-cited research-based ideas down to six pages. So it's on my website, okay?
Well, it's there along with thousands of other resources. Let's get to the positive behavior intervention and restorative justice, because they are the most highly touted. I've talked to state representatives in several states over the last 3 months about new legislations, and particularly California, which is really big on restorative justice. They have implemented it in multiple school districts around the state, and some counties have mandated that schools use this as a model to address bullying, as well as even curtail. Some have even looked at it as a response to some of the disciplinary actions in schools to curtail the school-to-prison pipeline. What's your take on the effectiveness of a program such as restorative justice?
Okay, we've got two programs you just made. One is positive behavior interventions and supports, and the other is restorative practices. So I'm going to discuss both of them. First of all, you should know I know everything about positive behavior interventions and support. Oh, well, maybe they would say I don't know everything. I know a lot about it because it was invented at the University of Oregon in the special ed program where I got my master's degree, and I live in Eugene, Oregon. So I've had the opportunity to pay close attention to that. There are very excellent components of the PBIS framework. That includes team-based leadership at the school level, database decision-making, ongoing monitoring of student behavior, universal screening, and ongoing professional development. The problem is that PBIS integrates a behavior management, rewards and punishment kind of approach. And I have seen firsthand, first of all, PBIS presents itself as being evidence-based, and they've got the school-wide PBIS program out there that they are presenting as evidence-based, and I've reviewed the evidence. I don't see evidence of effectiveness. Sorry. And if anybody wants
what
more
do you
information
see
on
some
that, please contact.
What do you see as some of the...
Okay.
Be specific. What are some of the drawbacks to it?
Okay. The biggest drawback, actually, is the token reward approach. Let me tell you a story. My son went to a school where they gave kids rewards for not being tardy, having homework done, having decent grades, and not getting into any incident reports. He got these rewards, got to go on wonderful trips to the ocean and the mountains, and it was great. But if you came to the school when those wonderful green zone kids were off on these trips, what you found is the kids who were left behind were the ones who were poorer, browner. These are the kids whose mom doesn't pick them up from school and make dinner and pay attention to their homework, and father, these are the kids who go home to the empty house because their mom's working a minimum wage job till 11 o'clock, and they're taking care of their siblings and cooking the soup out of a can, and they've got security and food insecurity, and they've experienced trauma, and so they're more easily triggered. And it's also the students with disabilities. A friend of mine's daughter was there. Her student has ADHD. Finally, her eighth grade year, the teacher petitioned for her to go on one of these trips because the teacher said she works harder than most of the kids in the class, but she never got to go on the trip. And this child was bullied throughout school by whom? The socially skilled, competent, compliant students who always got to go on the trips. Okay? So the token reward approach, the token reward approach is ineffective in motivating performance on complex behaviors. Research has demonstrated that. Interferes with the development of intrinsic motivation. That both complex behaviors and intrinsic motivation are essential to fostering positive relations. There is implicit bias in the delivery of these rewards, and this reward system models relational aggression by staff excluding certain students who don't meet the standards, and then the students follow and do the same thing.
All right. I need a little bit of clarification. So let me see if I can paraphrase what you shared with us. One, that this is a token system that rewards the violator, the bullier, by having them engage in certain activities to change their behavior and then reward them for their successes. At the same time, the student who was bullied is still in their environment, not getting their needs or whatever outcomes from that addressed. And it is, in fact, the bullier who's being rewarded. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah. What you have to do is you have to combine the fact we understand that it's the socially competent, compliant students who are the source of bullying. And then when you see that and merge that into how are these token reward systems working in schools, then you can see the whole picture.
It's, what are the results of that token system? Are they being successful?
There are three districts in my region, two of whom are shifting. One of them has shifted away. Another is shifting away from reliance on PBIS. And the third is a demonstration site for PBIS. The bullying rate on our youth risk behavior survey and the bullying rate at the district that is a dedicated PBIS user is 38%. So now, that there could be other reasons. I've been trying to figure this out, but that's the data that I'm seeing, and I'm trying to search for more data. Now, the overall PBIS framework is good, and what I'm seeing is schools that are taking that framework and integrating comprehensive social-emotional learning, trauma-informed care, culturally responsive practices, annual school surveys in addition to focusing on office disciplinary reports, and that is also what's needed. So we can build on the PBIS framework. We just have to integrate the more recent research insight on what kids at risk, and we've got to get rid of the token reward approach, period.
Do you know, I see some of this when schools look for reasons to escalate or tools to do it. Usually they've had a rash of it. Usually they themselves or members of the community have said, we've got to do something. They reach for the first thing they can grab. I'm not surprised that PIS is one of those tools because, one, it's immediate. Two, something everyone can dialogue about at the same time. I always have asked myself as an educator, I've never been an advocate for it because I saw it the same reasons that you did. There's some inherent biases that are in there. It isn't as directed as I would like for it to be in terms of not just changing behavior of a child, but changing the entire culture of a school. More reactionary than I like to be as a school leader. But I do see it as a benefit to those schools as a first step towards development of something more concrete and longer lasting and more substantive. My take on
absolutely, absolutely. Well, the reason PBIS is getting into many schools is because it's incorporated into the Individuals with Disability Education Act, and the federal government has
technical
funding for a very long period of time. So that's and what I want to see, and what I've started asking them for is, I got to see evidence of effectiveness. And I haven't seen it so far. And if anybody wants to look at the documents, they can write to me and ask for them. I haven't seen it so far. I have not seen adequate research evidence. And really, it's going to, yeah, so I haven't seen that. But we also need to talk about restorative practices, okay? There's been another big push for restorative practices.
Why don't you explain to our audience what that is? What restorative practices or restorative justice, many of them may know that to be as.
Right. Okay. Restorative practices are an approach to shift away from punishment, because punishment clearly doesn't work. So the underlying research for restorative practice is really sound. The idea is that people who have engaged in wrongdoing need to be helped to understand what they did that was wrong, the consequences of that, acceptability, and take steps to remedy the harm. This is solid, solid research in the direction that we need to go. The problem that I have seen, and I've talked to a lot of educators, is that the two practices that are currently recommended by people promoting restorative practices are the use of a circle. So if you've got a hurtful incident, you sit the whole class down and you talk about this and everybody talks and shares. Well, okay, three problems with that. Number one, no teacher has the time to do that. They've got instructional objectives to accomplish. Number two, if you've got a socially dominant or an at-risk kid who's engaging in behavior, the teacher, that is a situation that doesn't need to be discussed by all of the kids in the class. The at-risk kid's going to be damaged through this, and the socially dominant kid, nobody's going to speak up against them, or they're going to be heck to pay, okay? So this kind of a practice requires a highly trained facilitator, and there's no way we can get all of our teachers to that level. Then the other approach that we recommend is a full conference where everybody, and the parents, and the kids, and the witnesses, everybody gets together. Well, this is an extended, really in-depth approach, which may be appropriate in some circumstances, but it's simply not doable, not in the busy life of schools, and also requires a trained facilitator. So these two practices are the problem and the challenge. And so what we need and what I have developed, and there's more information on my website, is an approach that achieves the underlying goal of a restorative practice, which is understanding the harm that's caused, responsibility, and taking steps to remedy the harm, and then being reintegrated into the community. That's an important component. And do this differently. So I've developed what I call an accountability approach that takes students through a process of analyzing what they did, what their motivations were, how they rationalized this behavior, what they now recognize as the impact on others, how they might, so take them through problem solving, how can you remedy the harm? And comes up with an intervention approach that includes acknowledgement of the harm that was caused and an educational activity to increase their understanding of their behavior, a remedy to the school or the community, and a remedy to the kid who was damaged, and ongoing monitoring. And that should be implemented as a disciplinary consequence in abeyance so that we don't end up having problems with the blast of disciplinary code. But we're focusing on ensuring accountability, ensuring that the behavior stops, and helping this kid understand how, yeah, you made a mistake, here's how to remedy that mistake, and you're still welcome in school, and we want to help you on a great path.
You know, so what I'm hearing is that your model, Embracing Civility, and folks, Nancy just wrote an article that was featured Administration, which is an educational journal for educators. It's a magazine. I've been reading it for almost 15 years now and get a lot of the topics and trends from the magazine. So back in September, Nancy wrote an article entitled Teachable Moments on School Bullying, and the undertitle was Schools Must Collaborate with Students to Spread Civility. Nancy, with all the research you've done, understanding the PBIS system, restorative justice, and other that are today, you created a model that does what, in simply as possible, what does your model do that others do not?
A primary focus of my model is to address the social norms issue and do that by establishing a leadership team of kind and compassionate students so that we shift the balance, so that the path to social status within this school is by consistently being kind, respectful, inclusive, and to help, and teaching all students effective skills. And I've got a 5-part approach. How can you reach out to be kind? How can you safely say stop? When is it serious? Oh, and saying stop is, how do you help your friend who's been hurtful stop on it and fix it? Recognizing serious concerns, like the recent school shooting, he sent out notes, hey, I'm either going to be dead or in jail, and nobody reported. Excuse me. Recognizing when it's serious and needs to be reported to an adult, stop on it and fix it. Let's help kids who've been hurtful stop themselves, accept personal responsibility, and take steps to remedy the harm. And lastly, be positively powerful. How do we help kids who are being targeted? And one of the top key is we need to teach them self-regulation. If somebody's hurtful, you calm yourself, to give anybody the power to control how I feel about myself. And then you think things through and take it from there. And one of the steps that I recommend to kids who have been treated badly is within the next hour, they reach out to be kind to three other students.
Okay.
And that's a way of shifting them. Yeah.
I'm not a pessimist. Every time I read and I think, I put myself in school settings, having worked from, you know, K through 12 all the way through, and I always get stuck at high school. Right? When I say stuck at high school, when we start talking about the right thing to do, you're laughing because you know where I'm going with this, the right thing to do. And I'm telling a kid who just got his butt chewed out, or he's, you know, had to deal with the realities of his behavior, and I'm going to look at him, and he has a long pattern. This is a pattern that's probably existed for him or her since elementary school. This is why they're so aggressive with it. It's like, hey, I already know what consequences are. I'm accepting of those consequences. I'm used to it. Hell, I might have already been labeled a bully, so I'll deal with that. This is who I am. This is what I'm going to embrace. And all of a sudden, they're getting a new approach like yours, and you're saying to Billy, I need you to go out here, and now that you understand this, I need you to go be nice to three people. My first thought is, and I've met a lot of babies, and they might tell me to F you. Ain't no way, Dr. T. Man, I can't do that shit. Man, what are you talking about? How would you handle that? Does your model help people move? Because this is going to be a big step for a lot of kids.
Right. And it's an important step that we have to help kids. So as you were explaining, you were kind of, I'm trying to figure out exactly who you were explaining, kids who are engaging in bullying or kids who are being bullied.
Kids who were engaging. Yeah, I was describing a kid who was engaged in bullying.
Okay. A kid, the kind of kid you were describing who has done this for a long time, sounds to me more like the at-risk youth who we've got to get a lot of support around. And we need to help them with self-regulation and problem-solving and getting them with good connections and connecting them to a future vision of them being successful. So we've got to get trauma-informed care practices to support these kids because we want them to be successful. One of the factors and one of the things that really can help any kid, so this trauma kid has also been excluded, denigrated, doesn't feel a part. So we've got to find ways to make sure that kid has good connections with staff who are checking regularly and saying, hey, I believe in you. I really want to see you succeed. Are there any issues you're dealing with? How can I help you? So we've got to get them good connections. However, then we've also got the kids who are being routinely bullied. And for both of them, the at-risk youth and the kids who are being routinely bullied, if we can help them reach out to be kind in a regular manner, we will help them improve their peer acceptance. And there's research on this. They had two groups of students. They measured their peer acceptance. They said to these students, reach out to be kind 3 times a day. And the level of peer acceptance of those students increased, significantly increased. So what I did, okay, in my research, and I've been working on this for too many years, and by the way, at the high school level, the research shows that the bullying prevention programs that are promoted have zero effectiveness at the high school level. So it's not the fault of educators that this isn't working. What they've been trying to do has zero level of proven effectiveness. So what I tried to do is figure out the research that provides insight into how to influence people to engage in positive behavior and how to empower kids who are being treated badly, and a lot of that comes from trauma-informed care and positive psychology and strategies to increase positive peer intervention, the students who witnessed the program. And I've spent a lot of time digging into the research, and some of it, almost all of it is totally outside of the bullying prevention, came from the business, behavioral science in businesses, how to influence behavior and how to motivate people. That comes from the business community. Positive psychology is an exceptionally important approach, and the whole social norm risk prevention approach. So what I've done is I've drawn from research. If they go to my website, you can download the introduction document under Embrace Civility, and you'll see the key aspects of additional research that I've incorporated into my approach.
Well, Nancy, you know, one of the things I like as we begin to wrap up here is, and I want to simplify your approach, because it's one, you know, people, you've heard of The Secret, right? The Secret.
Right.
You know, right? So if someone says, I'm not going to be broke anymore, right? I'm not going to be broke. Well, if you live on that mantra and begin to act on that, well, what you end up doing is literally seeing all of the ways that you are, and you're working around those angles that you're never actually going to get over it. Whereas if you say, I'm going to be wealthy, or I'm going to be comfortable, and this is how I'm going to be comfortable, you begin to work in that mode.
Right.
Or if you're walking across a tightrope and you say, I'm not going to fall, I'm not going to fall, versus I'm going to make it. You're going to fall. Rather than saying, oh, I'm going to make it, I'm going to get your side.
I've actually totally incorporated that. That's why, and it's hard because, you know, while we want to do bullying prevention, if schools keep focusing on preventing bullying, they're not going to make progress. And that's why what I'm trying to shift is we are going to establish a positive, you actually have to shift also away from are going to, but our focus is on establishing a positive school climate where we're fostering positive relations that encompass kindness and inclusivity and civility to the hurtful incidents that do occur. So that's a positive affirmation of the direction in which we are proceeding. And I don't talk about The Secret, but since you brought it up, I've integrated that understanding into this. We have got to shift away from bullying is against the rule and we're going to punish you if you do this, to our focus is on embracing, making sure that every kid feels safe and welcome in this school.
Okay, I got a joke. See, I had a secret. My parents had a secret for bullying, and I'm going to get to that before. I got to discuss this before we open with parents. We open with accountability. My parents had a secret for bullying. They had a secret, and their secret was real simple. If I ever catch you bullying, I'm going to beat the hell out of you. And that was real simple to me. It was real simple. I was more afraid of my parents' response to even the thought of me bullying. As a matter of fact, my brothers and I were told the exact opposite. If you see somebody bullying, boy, you better not stand around and watch that happen. That's what we heard. So they didn't approach it with, I better not see you do it. I already knew that. What they did tell us was, you better not stand around and watch it happen. That's
right.
What they told me. I better not be part of it. So it was never part of me. The other, you know, if anything, I was like, what are you doing, man? Leave him alone, right? Whatever.
Right.
Or leave her alone, whatever the case may be. So it was a culture that was established in our home around bullying. It was no question that you were not going to be bullied. I passed that same mindset down to my kids. And here's the question. Nancy, I have encountered in my 27 years tons of bullies. And I have found almost to a person, almost, male or female, that they had some extreme hurt. And when I say hurt, I'm not talking trauma. I'm talking even minimally dissatisfaction. And I have to say this. Some of that was with their home life, including their parents. They know, let me tell you this, kids know when they have shitty parents. They know when they're getting shitty parenting. Trust me. There's an old adage in education. When you talk to a kid, when you're a teacher. And I just tell my kids this all the time at the beginning of school in the first week. Don't tell me what goes on in your home. You know, I believe half of what you tell me goes on in your home. Half of what goes on in the school. Maybe. You know, believed everything your kid said about what happened to your house, calling the cops. So there's a reality that I have observed out of experience with some bullies, a lot of them, that there's a dissatisfaction, aside from the dominance theory, there is an aspect of it. It's manifested
okay.
that way. But okay. what's been your, do
so,
you see that? Do you find that to be a pattern?
That's okay. So we're talking about the two natures of bullying, and that is absolutely a pattern with the at-risk kids who are aggressive, and they have not received sufficient support from home, which is why we have got to get develop connections with them, with school staff, with other strong people within the community. We've got to establish those connections. There's been a fair amount of research on the kids who are hurtful to achieve social dominance, and what I have not yet seen in the research literature, so it's still a question for me, is what is the difference between those kids who move, who have leadership capabilities and move on the path of dominating others, and those who have leadership capabilities and move on the path of being consistent and kind. And I think that is also related to the messages that they're receiving from home. So if you have a parent who says, you know, you got to be boss out there. I want to see you team manager, and you need to knock them down, you know, and that's what you, so if you have a parent who is demonstrating being hurtful to achieve dominance, you're going to have kids who are hurtful to achieve dominance. But if you have a parent who is demonstrating kindness and respect, one of the things my kids say about me, and they do now, and my daughter is working in retail right now, and she says, I didn't realize how important it was that you taught us that the person working behind the counter is a wonderful person who you need to always treat with respect, and the number of people who never learned that. So I do think this starts from home, but there's kind of insufficient research at this point in time to figure out which path. I did have a friend who's a former elementary school principal, and she said, you can identify the kids who by middle school are going to be hurtful to achieve dominance unless you get them on the right path. You can identify them when they walk into kindergarten. So if we can identify those kids with the leadership skills and strive to get them onto the positive path as young as possible, then as they grow up, they can become the kind, compassionate student leaders who are consistently helping others and embracing civility. So that's what we've got to do, especially at the elementary school level, before puberty kicks in.
Well, let's close out this way. I opened the show talking about the new law that passed in this town in New York that criminalizes parents for the behavior of parents for not addressing bullying by, if their child commits a bullying act at least twice, the second offense, the parent's subject to 15 days in jail and or a substantial fine. I think it was $250 to $500 fine. Will, do you see that I know that the law is only there to provide safety measures. And obviously, this town feels like bullying is such a huge issue, and nothing's being done about it. And it hasn't changed, so they feel like they need to put the accountability where they feel it belongs. I'm not so sure I don't agree with them in some regards. How do you think it's going to impact bullying?
First of all, the law is going to be deemed unconstitutional because it is, defining bullying and proving that bullying occurred. It's the same issue as did bullying violate the code. So the law will be deemed unconstitutional. There are actually in every state laws that allow parents to be held financially liable for the torts, wrongdoings, intentional torts committed by their children. So there would actually be a way for parents to sue the parents of the students who are being consistently bullied. And since it's under a certain rate, actually they could do that in small claims courts, which would be an interesting possible path. But what we've got to do is we've got to help schools shift what they're doing away from failed adult control approach to a more positive school climate approach. And I know that's difficult. We've got schools. Well, educators are overwhelmed at this point in time, and so much pressure for the academic scores. We're having a lot of people, the Aspen Institute just released a report and said, hey, all of these distinguished scientists say you got to focus on the emotional well-being and emotional skills of your students also, and it's crazy making that we should have to be saying that or promoting that. So that's actually why I wrote the book for parents, and I've included all of the positive strategies, but I've put in there, we need parents going to the school board, doing a better job presenting the situation to the principal, saying, going to the site council and saying, hey, this isn't working. What's our school doing? This is what the school should be doing. I'm actually hoping that maybe if my book gets picked up by parent groups, that there would be more pressure on the schools to focus on the social emotional well-being. And I think educators want to do that. Educators have been bullied themselves. They are overwhelmed. They have insufficient financial resources. And so much of the focus is on these blasted test scores. If there's some way for them to kind of release the pressure on that and focus on making sure their school is safe and welcome for all kids, they're going to be happier. I mean, teachers and principals don't want to have to deal with this. They are going to be happier. So that's what I'm trying to do.
Well, I'm glad you're here. I'm glad you're doing it. And folks, if you've heard, Nancy could go on for hours on this topic, and there's probably not a whole lot you could ask her about this subject that she could not answer, but she's already put this together. So you don't have to tune in here. Actually, go to her website. It's embracecivility.org. And you will get a great overview, not only of what we've discussed tonight, but exactly what should and can be done by schools and even parents to address bullying. And Nancy, I think in these times, this issue is only going to become even more critical in securing strong cultures and climates in our schools from a safety standpoint.
The youth risk behavior data for 2017 is going to be released this fall, and that will include the data on bullying. And based on some data I've already seen, the rate of bullying is going to go up. This is not the fault of schools. This isn't because of anything that schools are doing or not doing. This is the result of what's happening in society, and this is what schools have to address in order to ensure that students are safe and welcome and are able to achieve academically. And the data is going to be coming out kind of towards the end of October and November. At least in Oregon, it's going to come out end of October. And I think the rates of bullying are going to be significantly higher.
Well, I'm sorry that I have to agree with you, because I do. I agree with you. And it is going to go up, and people will continue to make excuses. And schools don't need to be in to do that. There are resources out here and people out here like Nancy that can give you some strong direction with not only selection, but probably the most important aspect, implementation and monitoring. Those are some of the biggest aspects of any new model. So, Nancy, what are some of the ways that our listening audience are interested in contacting you about your program in their schools? How could they get in touch with you?
Okay, I'm available at embracecivility.org. What I've tried to do is develop an approach that includes professional development for the school climate leaders, also provides them with resources they can use to educate their school staff, and I also have a student program available. And what I'm trying to do, I just heard a very marvelous lady who does consulting in this area just told me that she worked extensively for a school district, and she educated all of their staff, 25 at a time, $3,200 per day. And I'm going, yikes, I don't think that's doable in most places. So I've done a lot of study in how can we do effective professional development and effective change in school. And what I'm trying to do is provide that in a cost-effective manner that will also include and incorporate those aspects that are most likely to accomplish positive change.
Fantastic. Well, Nancy, thank you again. As always, it's good having you here. And you're always welcome back anytime.
It is always great to talk with you. And people might know that we communicate in back channels also, because I frequently ask you questions. Hey, what does this sound like? Is very helpful to me.
Hey, well, that's what we're all here for. And listen, by the way, I want to thank you for connecting with Ann Collier on the show a couple of maybe it was a month ago, and she was fantastic. The group of people, the researchers that you work with, I mean, the range, I mean, you know, some of these names people know because they see them on television, but you are with this group of people who I just love reading through the thread of the emails that I'm included in, because I'm like, wow, I didn't know that. Or it leads me down a road that I would have never even thought existed on the topic. So I want to thank you for that.
You're very welcome. What happened over 5 years ago is that Congress was proposing a law that they were going to address cyberbullying by making it a federal crime. And I brought together the people who are working in digital safety issues, and we've expanded from there. And we just talk with each other, and we've got this ongoing discussion group, and if anybody's interested in joining, let me know.
Oh, wait, before you go, I have to do this. I try not to. I really do. Oh, God, let me take a deep breath. The First Lady has proposed to promote anti-bullying, right? Every First Lady has, you know, her thing, her agenda.
Right.
It has been, you know, 10 months, going on 11 months, and other than announcing that she was going to start an anti-bullying, national anti-bullying campaign, if anybody would know, you, aside from whoever's closest to her in the White House, what's the likelihood that we will see an anti-bullying campaign from our First Lady?
Apparently she's supposed to focus on cyberbullying, and none of the experts in cyberbullying have been contacted by her. The first issue that she would have to deal with, from my perspective, is the issue of rationalization, spinning it, denying personal responsibility, denying the harm, and blaming the victim. You can find some pretty consistent examples from her husband. The second issue she would have to deal with is that of retaliation, which we didn't get to, but a lot, my survey has shown that impulsive retaliation is at the heart of a lot of hurtful behavior. And when you are promoting the idea that if somebody hurts you, you need to hit them back 10 times harder, that is essentially totally going against what we need to do to address these issues. So,
you just answered it. You don't have to say any more. You don't have to say any more. I think you covered that pretty accurately. All right, Nancy, thank you again. And again, folks, if you want to learn more about Nancy Willard and her anti-bullying efforts, please go to Embrace Civility.
No, not anti-bullying. My focus on fostering positive school climate.
There you go. Positive school climate, culture. I'd like for you to explore culture and climate, because we'll have a talk about it. It's really, it's unique. I've got my take. I'd love to get your opinion on it. We can do that another time. But embracecivility.org is the website. Nancy Willard, thank you once again. As she giggles her way out. She's always fun to have
you
here.
Much.
You're very welcome.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Folks, bully. You heard Nancy say, going away. As a matter of fact, it's only going to grow. I've said this 1,000 times. I'm going to say it again until everybody knows it. I'm not going to say anything profound. Schools are a microcosm of our society. And what I've observed in my lifetime working, going to school, and I spent more than half my life in schools, either as a student or as an educator, I can tell you this. Schools are not parents. They're not. Yes, teachers and administrators have the responsibility of taking care of your children. If you listen to my show at any time, I always remind you of that, especially if I'm talking to educators who screw up. Yeah, you're supposed to act in place of the parent during school. But you aren't actually the parent. Thing you're responsible for, and I've said this to every staff I've ever worked with, you are responsible for sending them home minimally no worse than they arrived. That's the minimum. If we do our job right, we send them home every day better than when they arrived. That's the accountability of schools. On the other side of that coin, I think society has placed on the shoulders and backs of educators for decades the responsibility of fixing the ills of our society that we as adults perpetuate daily. And the way that we talk to each other, the way that we resolve problems. People about her daughter being in sales retail. You guys have been in the stores before. You know how people talk to each other. You know how people love to use power and displays of aggression and anger to establish dominance over sales clerks, over toll booth meter maids, over anybody that doesn't agree with them. I don't want to talk about it. We have a leader of our nation who operates that way. It has become even more of the American dialogue, the manner in which we speak, the manner in which we respond. Why in the world are we surprised that our young people are mimicking that? We're happy when they mimic their first words from us. We're happy when they mimic something we've been trying to teach them at the age of five and they finally get. We're happy when they mimic some of our ideas. Why would you be surprised that the behavior in schools relative to bullying or any other type of disruptive behavior is new to you? I always say to parents when they say to me, well, he doesn't do that at home, as I raise an eyebrow, going, don't even try it. You mean to tell me, after all this time, he waits till he comes to school to do this? Either you are one scared parent, or this is one confused child. Either way, we're going to clean this up today. There has to be accountability. And I always say to parents all the time, we didn't bring him into the world. So I'm going to ask you the question. When you bring him or her in, what did you want for them? What did you want them to be? How do they do it? How do you support it? What do you do when it doesn't happen? And is it working? Start there. You don't need the courts to throw you in jail to be a good parent. You don't need to be fined to be a good parent. You may need the advice of a teacher, some insight into your child when they're not with you. As a reminder, most kid parents, they do recognize this. Your child spends most of his waking hours with other people, other than you. That's why I always say to parents, you're telling me what? And how many times a day do you see him in the course of a week? What are you saying to me? I don't know him better, but I have some information that might be valuable to you as you try to parent. See, in establishing good homeschool relationships, that's where that dialogue needs to be. That's where that understanding of roles needs to be. I firmly believe we need Nancy Willards today. We need organizations like Embrace Civility to help us get back to center. She's not selling a program. That's why I like her. That's why I have her on the show so much. And there's several others I like. Gabriella Enway is one who speaks of the same type of message as Nancy Willard. Yes, that's a free endorsement. I find these to be two valuable people. I've named several others, but their names escape me at the moment. But this is where we are. We have to be cognizant of our role. And yes, I have been, and anybody who's worked with me will tell you, I will hold you accountable to your role, whether you're a teacher or whether you're a parent. I did not bring your child into the world. By the time I've seen them, they've been with you, you've shaped them. They just shown up, and I've got to what? Grow them within the context of what my job requires, whatever skills that I have and understandings of my job. After that year's over, he's still yours. She's still yours. Yes, I'm sorry. This isn't new. I've always done that. And every parent may not have always initially agreed. Trust me, they haven't. But when they see how it works and how they benefit, and more importantly, how their job benefits, things change. And let me say this about parents who aren't doing it right. I've always reminded my teacher of this as they come and complain and say, Mrs. Turner is doing this and she's back again and she's this and this. See, and I ask them to describe the behaviors of the child, and they do. And I ask, do you think Miss Turner sends Johnny to school and says, I want you to cuss her out. And if she says this, tell her to F off. You tell her to kiss your ass. If that girl says that again, you go punch him in the face. You go, well, I don't think she says it. Okay. Then let's not attribute Johnny's behavior to Miss Turner. Let's call and ask Miss Turner what her expectations of Johnny are. Tell her the circumstances and then ask her what she would have expected Johnny to do. Now you have a baseline on which to evaluate the judgment of the parent and how much it aligns with the school rules and policies and how much of this is just she didn't know or know to communicate those things. Because here's where it comes down to me. I've seen parents who have dysfunctional kids who mean well. When I say mean well, they want what I want, exactly what I want for them. It's no different. The problem is that they haven't had the experiences that they desire. So you can see something but not know how to get it. Never had anybody show you. And just because you're an adult doesn't mean all of a sudden you've gained that knowledge and insight. It doesn't. And sometimes educators have to be delicate. But also, in being delicate, acknowledge strategies and ways and things they need to be thinking about. Not by telling, but by asking. So I had teachers write down assumptions they were making. I did this in activity. I do it all the time. Write down all your assumptions that you're making about the parent. Good. Now turn those into questions rather than declarative statements, because they're not facts. Just because you assume something doesn't mean it's true. Just means you operate out of it, and that's the only truth. That's the only truth. Well, this nation has a huge problem with it. It's not relegated to a group. It's not relegated to a group. It's us. That's who we become. And you know how I can say that with such certainty? Take a look at what's happening in our schools. You want to know where a nation really is about? I can't say this enough. Look at what your kids are doing. That's what you are. That's where we are. Look at our kids. Grown-ups, you've heard me say that. Grown-ups are grown-ups. Hey, by the time you're 35, dude, really? I'm not trying to. What? I don't have much patience for that. You should know better by now. We're trying to be better. But our youth... And we're going to have to redefine youth. It's not an age anymore, I can tell you that. Bullying. Programs. Ideologies. Systemic methods. Creating new cultures. Changing the climate in the school. Creating new paradigms about what we're trying to fix. That's what Nancy Willer was talking to us about tonight. Tomorrow morning, guys, don't miss it. We, Myla, Jeannie, and I will be on tomorrow at 8 o'clock a.m. for an Ain't That Early morning show. Every Tuesday and Thursday and tomorrow, we're going to be tackling education topics. I will recap a little bit of this because I have a couple of pieces to add to this. We're also going to be talking about if you've never heard of the River Room in New York. You might want to Google it. I'm not going to give you any hints. Google it. The Rubber Room. We're going to be talking about teachers who've been identified as ineffective, warehoused, and now they're putting back to work. There is also a huge teacher shortage in America, one that nobody's talking about, and you're going to be amazed at the reason why. You're going to be amazed at the reason why. Some of you won't. Some of you won't. That's tomorrow morning. So, please join us tomorrow, 8 o'clock a.m. for an Ain't That Early Morning Show with myself and Michael G. Until then, everybody have a great evening. See you tomorrow.
You've been in the bullpen with Dr. T. Follow Dr. T on Twitter and Facebook at Dr. T Educates. And on the web, visit www.drteducates.com. Join us every Monday at 7 p.m. Eastern in the bullpen with Dr. T. Become empowered. Get involved.